Hello, East is a Podcast listeners. This is Amanda. You may know me as Cat Content Only on Twitter, or you may know me from previous previews on Sina's feed. Sina and I have actually been working together on my own podcast the past few months. You're about to listen to a preview of the most recent episode of this podcast. In this one, Mira, Jorge, and Ron from the DSA International Committee come on to talk about that What the Left Should Do About China article in The Nation. We talk about the colonialist framework in which it was written, the misrepresentation of Vijay Prashad's comments, and finally, whether or not China is socialist. If you enjoy this preview, I would love it if you'd subscribe to the pod, which you can do at patreon.com/radiofreeamanda. Thank you for listening.
But the article did interview, a dissenting opinion. They interviewed Vijay Prashad, and he has since come out and said that his quotes were wildly mischaracterized. So in the article, he's quoted as saying, "The cultural genocide charge is one that I'm not entirely." He's talking about Xinjiang here. "The cultural genocide charge is one that I'm not entirely sympathetic to," said Prashad, who has visited China numerous times, but has not been to Xinjiang. "Education policy is a big part of poverty alleviation," he added. "The fact is that most modern societies have forced people to have an education." And then the quote stops there. And then this is David Kleon here, and he's kind of summarizing, trying to summarize what he's saying, what Vijay is saying. So he says, "In his telling, what is happening to the Uyghurs is analogous to what countries like the United States and Australia did to their indigenous populations, or what the British Empire did in his native India. But somewhat to my surprise, he didn't mean it that in a bad way." And then Prashad is quoted again. "That's the price people pay. You can't preserve some cultural forms and alleviate or eradicate absolute poverty." And Ron, you sort of mentioned this a few minutes ago, but I sort of wanted to get your thoughts on that quote and, how they characterize what Vijay Prashad said in comparing this development project in Xinjiang with specifically what the British Empire did in India.
Yeah. I mean, I know there are a lot of different opinions on Xinjiang, but I really thought comparing it to the British Raj in India was totally uncalled for. Or I think it betrays sort of the assumptions that David Kleon, a white guy born and brought up in the US, made. I mean, what the British did in India was, laying down railroads to extract resources in a more efficient manner, to extract Indian wealth and transport it to the British metropole. The British agricultural and tax policies led to multiple famines that killed millions of people in South Asia. The British regime engaged in divide and rule practices that still haunts South Asia today in terms of communal violence that people experience. And on a macro level, South Asia went from being one of the wealthiest regions in the world to now being known for poverty and other social ills. So I thought making that specific comparison was absolutely preposterous, especially because, again, whatever people want to say about Xinjiang, there is a socialist tradition of governments using state power to improvements in society. And I think that's, Russian Empire was a very feudal country with huge wealth inequalities where people were mostly illiterate or where medical conditions were next to non-existent. And the Soviet government and the Communist Party of the USSR made investments that led to material improvement and well-being for a lot of people in terms of literacy, in terms of combating endemic diseases, in terms of uplifting the people fundamentally. And we can see that in Cuba today, and we can even see that in Kerala as well, which is a state in India. So I thought comparing modernization practices and colonial extraction and immiseration of people was completely preposterous, to be frank with you. And also betrays the assumptions that people make, especially people who don't really have experience, connections to post-colonial countries, or have an understanding of those countries, like Vijay Prashad does. I mean, Vijay Prashad is Indian, so that also was frankly insulting, in my opinion.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you going in depth in like the differences between development models like in the Soviet Union and China versus like a resource extraction that's part of colonialism. But it's really indicative of, you know, this Western line of thinking that the US and China are equally bad state actors and we should hold all states accountable for like their human rights, their record on human rights. You know, this all states are bad kind of analysis that's really common, like not only like among anarchists, but also among like a lot of academics as well. The thing with academics is that they like to criticize everything, but really offer nothing. And so I think this is very indicative of what this article actually does, right? It's a way of countering like this new Cold War like movement, which is like a very defined position, and just ends up nobody in the article really had a solution, right? There was no sort of defined position within the article. It just served to like kind of muddy the waters a bit within like this China discourse. And the only thing that they can say is that like further escalation between the US and China would be a disaster, but they still like see China as an equally bad actor. And, you know, there's this one quote that says, I forget, like I have it in my notes, but I'm not sure who said it, but he's quoted as saying, among the widely cited risks of a new Cold War, beyond the obvious risk of actual military conflict involving nuclear armed belligerents, are the lost opportunities to work together on climate change and other transnational threats. So I think this was actually David Kleon in the article who said that, but he, you know, compared the US with China and like called them both nuclear armed belligerents, right? Even though since China developed its nuclear capability in like 1964, it's adopted a no first use policy, meaning that they like will never be the first to use its nuclear weapons under any circumstance, and has called on the US to reduce its nuclear stockpile. So the comparison that the US and China are just like two equally bad actors is just like, I don't know, it's just like a really silly argument to me.
I was just going to say that I find that sort of equally absurd. And I think that it can be kind of deconstructed even just by looking at some basic data. You know, whatever your opinions are of the actual governments in play, how are they interacting with other nations? You know, are they funding regime change efforts? Have they been involved in multiple wars? The United States has over 800 military bases around the world in other countries, all over the world. I mean, everywhere. And I believe China has like two or four, something along those lines. It's not comparable. Even the military arsenals and the arsenals of weapons are not comparable. China right now, although they are, you know, I would say upgrading their military capacity in certain ways, if you really look at what those ways are, it's a defensive capacity. They are not building a forward, outward force that's meant to go out and, you know, change governments in other places or do invasions, because that's not how they operate. They aren't interested in doing that, and that's not how they interact with other nations. So I think it's really kind of falling into a very flat and therefore not true analysis of, you know, geopolitics to say that the United States, an imperial power, and China, a formerly colonized nation, you know, led by a communist government, are really all that similar in any way.
Yeah, I think another point regarding what Mira just said, which I think was well said, is it is an ahistorical argument as well, in the sense that, you know, Mira touched a little bit on it, but, you know, if you look at just like the U.S. expounding its influence in the world, it's done primarily through aggressive interventionist and militaristic means. You know, the U.S. has been involved in, you know, if we just stick to just direct U.S. involvement, in terms of militarily. We have 6 or 7 direct involvement by the U.S. in this century. And forget about, say, post-World War II, you know, you have Vietnam, Korea, you know, and a bunch of other situations, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. Keep going. I could keep going all day, but point is, you know, and not even including, say, regime change operations and fundings of projects. But, you know, that's the way that the U.S. has kind of exerted its influence in the world. And, you know, where has China done since, at least since the past 40, 50 years, has China been involved in anything that isn't beyond, say, a border dispute, right? It's not to suggest that China has not been involved militarily with other countries, but they've almost entirely been with those around its border. You know, there has been a history with, say, Vietnam or India or, say, you know, on the border of, you know, Korea, for instance. But again, this is still within the what would be within a reasonable nation state's domain. And I have no real love for, say, nation states, what have you, but this is the world we operate in. So it's like that's even if you are, say, someone who is interested in nation states not being an entity that continues persisting in the world, this is still, we live in this world. So that's how you have to operate. Then historically, China has not been really been doing that compared to the U.S. And even if you say you take this assumption that, say, China is becoming a, you know, a superpower that's like interested in empire, the way it's kind of been doing, it's been mainly on a mercantile basis of just doing trade. And when it does trade with nations, it doesn't really get involved with the domestic affairs of nations. It really just has, all right, we have this deal. We're going to, for certain aspects in terms of, you want to build a port? We'll loan you the money. We'll give you a rate that's lower than the IMF loans, which is why so many nations are interested in the Belt and Road Initiative. You know why? It's because they're offering a better rate than, say, it's currently, you know, if America is so upset about it, then why are they upset about them just following the rules of quote unquote free market economics, right? It's like offering a better rate. But also, you know, there is not really been much evidence of this so-called debt-trap diplomacy. You know, this wonderful article in The Atlantic that just discredited, and this is very mainstream, like typical Beltway scholar that wrote this article talking about it. There's just no evidence to suggest that the Belt and Road Initiative is trapping countries around the world in debt. So even if you take that maximalist kind of approach that, you know, China is becoming a superpower in a mercantilist way, that is a significant difference in terms of the way a power operates in the world than, say, the U.S. invading and bullying and attacking and invading countries.
The only thing I would add is that I think when it comes to issues of, you know, what China does or what many other post-colonial nation does, I think a lot of people in the U.S., especially white American leftists, don't really know what it's like to live in a country and have the collective memory of having been invaded or having had your sovereignty taken away, having been dictated policy by people who live thousands of miles away from you. And I think a lot of people with white American leftists, especially in the US, cannot really. And I think that's where some of these notions of like global citizenship, as Mira said earlier, comes. So I think there's a big distinction between countries like, let's say, China or Cuba, who invest in their own in resources to defend their own sovereignty against Western intervention, versus countries like the United States, which frequently uses language of human rights in order to intervene in other countries while not respecting human rights within its own borders. And this is where, like, you know, the British colonial example in India also comes into play, because, you know, the British use language of human rights and women's rights in particular in order to justify its colonization of the subcontinent. And of course, that has led to a lot of political actors in the country to really emphasize sovereignty. So I think we really need to sort of understand why sovereignty and self-determination is so important within the post-colonial context, which a lot of us can't necessarily relate to.
I think another reason why China kind of sort of presents a problem to the US left is that there doesn't really seem to be any consensus on the left about China. Like the article itself asks, one reason China confounds the left is that it's hard to classify in terms of its basic ideology. Is it a doctrinaire Maoist People's Republic or an integral part of the globalized neoliberal order? Does it represent an alternative to American economic hegemony, or does it undergird that hegemony? Should it be credited with lifting hundreds of millions of workers out of rural poverty, or blamed for using its cheap and politically powerless workers to undermine organized labor and anti-corporate regulatory regimes worldwide? Is it, in short, communist or capitalist? So that's like, that is the question, I think, that like the basic underlying question that like this all stems from, right? There doesn't seem to be any sort of consensus on the left about China. And I feel the popular opinion, at least in the US among the left, is that China abandoned its socialist path in like when Deng Xiaoping announced his open door policy in like the late 70s. And it opened up the country to foreign capitalist investment. While others would say that this opening up was necessary in order for China to build its productive forces. So I was interested in getting your all's views on this. Is China communist? Is China, or is China socialist? Is China capitalist? Jorge, do you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, my answer to that question of whether it's socialist or capitalist, I think is, I think that question is a bit reductive. My hot take would probably be both, in the sense that its economy is clearly rooted in a what would be typically defined as state capitalist, but its goals in terms of it, how it's kind of developed, is very clearly socialist. And, you know, to kind of give some context historically, is that in 1979, you know, shortly after Mao Zedong died, and then the Gang of Four kind of collapsed in terms of its coalition power, and it, following the wake of the Cultural Revolution, the stance in China, from my understanding, among a lot of people who lived there, was that it was after a very long tumultuous period of, you know, change, you know, infighting, many ways there was no government that could be described as, like, in terms of just not much stability that existed in China. A lot of people just wanted to have a stability and being able to develop their own lives, because at some point the revolution must be able to kind of situate, and like people need to move on with their lives in many ways, you know. And at this point in time as well, you know, China was very poor, very underdeveloped. Hundreds of millions of people lived in the countryside. And to be clear, nothing wrong with living in a rural community. You know, I'm from a rural town in Texas. But the fact of the matter is that if those regions are not developed to be able for people to, you know, be self-sustaining and have developed themselves in the best, highest way that they can possibly be, then this is like the definition of poverty. And so Deng Xiaoping and other members of the Communist Party, I think there's also a certain element of, oh, Deng Xiaoping is uniquely was interested in this policy. You know, a lot of the interest in market reforms and open door policy was shared by many members of the party, but also was said near the end of the life of Mao Zedong. So this is not it did not manifest as some out of the blue, so to speak, in terms of where this kind of came from. And the idea is that we are interested in, you know, the Soviet Union at that time was also something that exists in the background of a stagnating socialist power, and clearly was at the time not doing well, and it was in even decline, lobbies at that point, and also an interest in making sure that the population and of China was developing in a way such that people were living better than when they were under colonialism. So the idea was to, you know, if the Communist Party of China maintained control of the government, then you could allow foreign capital to come in such that basically capitalists can come in, they're interested in increasing their profit, and then they'll develop the country, because they have an interest in doing so. And so that's essentially what they did. And it's important to keep in mind the, you know, there has been no equivalent in modern history of a country developed in the way that China has in terms of its GDP per capita. In 1989, the GDP per capita of China was about $200-ish per person. By 2019, and basically 30 years later, the per capita, the GDP per capita was about $10,000-$12,000. That's an unimaginable change in terms of standard of living. Now, if you see images of Shanghai in 1989 and then in 2019, unrecognizable, not even close in terms of the change that occurred in a single generation. So, you know, in a sense, in terms of the economy, it's clear that it's, you know, many aspects of it are capitalist and has capitalists. But, you know, this is great point that I've heard in this, that I've heard before, but basically, like, in the United States, the way that the government is structured, billionaires and capitalists have a significant sway in terms of the politics and the runnings of policies in this country by donating of campaigns in terms of in elections or even running for office. In China, the way that it's structured, capitalists do not have nearly any influence in the running of the country, in the way that it operates, because it is structured in such a way that it is not possible. And in many ways, the Communist Party of China has a lot of been very strict and very, you know, the capitalists are subsumed by the Communist Party of China. You know, we could have a debate in terms of like whether or not that the way that they interact with them is appropriate or not. But it's hard to say if you're looking at it from the lens of what is actually occurring. It's hard to argue that, say, that capitalists are above the party in China.